thank you all for your kind attention so far. It's been good to have spent some time with you. I wasn't sure how many of you I would know, but I did feel like I was among friends when I got here. I knew quite a few of you, a number of Bible school students. If I didn't get to say hello to you, hi. Good to see y'all again. One thing before going into this afternoon's message, the song we sang, God of Grace and God of Glory, I don't know if y'all took notice of it because I was thinking it like I did because of how I was thinking about this, but Brother Keith alluded to it a couple of times, and I just want to pound that nail one more time, and that is that we do live in 2025. The man wrote this song, this Henry Fawcett, or however you say his name, Harry. The date after his name is 1930. I don't know if that means when he wrote the song or if that's when he was born. Either way, this is a while ago, and this particular individual felt the need to write, "Lo, the hosts of evil round us scorn thy Christ, assail his ways." And then he winds up that stanza by saying, grant us wisdom, grant us courage for the living of these days. I believe that it is possible to live victorious Christian lives in 2025. If it wasn't, we would not be here. So I just want to say that. I know some of the subjects, some of the things we talked about seem perhaps more negative than positive, but there's lots of reasons to be hopeful. And we're here. And so the prayer, of course, is like the songwriter, grant us wisdom and courage. Child sacrifice. Turn with me in your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 20. Leviticus 20, I'm going to just read the first three, well, maybe five verses. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, "Again thou shalt say to the children of Israel, whosoever he be of the children of Israel or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones, and I will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people, because he hath given of his seed to Molech, to defile my sanctuary and to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do in any ways hide their eyes from the man when he giveth of his seed unto Molech and kill him not, then I will set my face against that man and against his family and will cut him off and all that go whoring after him to commit whoredom with Molech from among their people." That's some pretty harsh language, but harsh language is needed when actions are equally harsh. What exactly is giving of the seed to Molech? Well, we don't have any details in the Bible about that necessarily. You have to rely on some outside sources. Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 35. "And they built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to cause their sons and daughters to pass through the fire unto Molech, which I commanded them not. Neither came it into my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin." So they didn't listen. Leviticus is way early in the history of the Israelites. Jeremiah is toward the end of the history, before or around the time of exile, and they didn't listen. And so God is taking them out of their land as a punishment for that. This message, this message is based on the idea that there's a connection to the pagan worship of Molech, which involved child sacrifice. This ancient practice is always condemned in the Bible. So the Lord is completely opposed to child sacrifice. In our country from 1973, which is the time when the Roe v. Wade case was heard, and so on. There have been somewhere around 63 million children aborted in just the U.S. That's an estimate. There's probably really no way to know for sure. And I don't know what the worldwide estimates are. It's tragic beyond all words. At the same time, though, there are advances in technology beyond all belief that help people bear children. It's one of those strange paradoxes of our society. Very odd. On one hand, we will kill a child, and on the other hand, we will do questionable things to make sure that we can conceive a child. And I wonder how many are the same people, because at one point in their life, having a child looked like too much problem and pain, and then it looked like too much problem and pain not to have a child. I'm not sure. I certainly have no way of knowing that. But it occurs to me that the likelihood is pretty high that it could be the same person, same couple. In this message, we're going to try to examine three questions. First question is, what does child sacrifice look like today? Second question is, why do we try so hard to control the conception and birth of children? And then third, is there a thoughtful, God-honoring way for us to live and think about these things? What exactly is child sacrifice mentioned here as giving one's seed to Molech? Well, it's again one of those things that make you wonder if Apostle Paul would say, don't talk about that. It's too horrific. Well, let's just say that it involved killing children in ways that required a ritual with lots of noise to drown out the cries of the children, and it involved fire sometimes, and sometimes it involved things like heating up a metal image and laying the child in the arms. Just horrific things that any reasonable and thinking person would say should never happen. But I think it's safe to say that the pain and suffering that an innocent child undergoes in the death by abortion, just because it isn't obvious to us, because it's hidden away, because it's quiet, it's done under cover, we may not immediately spot the horrors as the same, but the hypocrisy is certainly there. It is just as horrible. And the other hypocrisy that needs to be pointed out is that a medical team with the same skill and resources to abort children probably could save the life of the very same child if the parents wanted it. It's amazing how prematurely children can be born and still be saved. Let's not forget that this sin will have a toll on any nation that practices it. And just like the Israelites found out that God allowed them to be taken into exile from the land, bad things will happen to a society that decides to sacrifice their children. So what are the modern analogs to Molech worship? Well, in the old ancient cult, the core sacrifice was literally a child sacrificed, often for prosperity, fertility, or national security. That was the belief. And we could look at that and say, well, that's silly. Well, abortion today, when it's framed for career advancement, convenience, or personal peace, how is that any different? It's seems to me to be about the same thing. Modern justifications, as the old people, the ancient practice, it was a noble offering for the good of the family, for the good of the tribe, or for some way to appease the gods. And the moral justification for today's practice of aborting babies is it appeals to freedom or social necessity, autonomy, those sorts of things. You could even argue that there's a religious ritual. There's a priestly class in the old ways, the idol, the drums, the ceremonial burning. Today, we have highly specialized clinicians that don't have a visible ritual per se, but they they have their place in the offering of the children. Cultural acceptance. Well, the Ammonites, the Canaanites, different cultures accepted this as normal. The Israelites, unfortunately, seem to have fallen into that, and it brought the judgment of God on them. And today, cultural normalization of abortion, euthanasia, and fertility control those words aren't new. We don't see them as perhaps as shocking as they are. You could make a comparison to the location that children were sacrificed in the valley outside of Jerusalem, high places, remote shrines, away from the public. Even though it was a public ritual, it involved getting out in a place where it seemed more acceptable in some way. And today, we do it removed from the public view in the little clinics and places that are the modern equivalent of Tophet, as it were. So, what can we say? It seems that there are modern parallels, and just as God called for total condemnation of child sacrifice, I think Christians today would be in the same camp when it comes to abortion. And I don't think I'm going to say much more about abortion, because I don't know that I'm talking to a group of people that would in any way consider, once a pregnancy has begun, that they would end that pregnancy for any reason. One of our doctors, when we were having children, he would always tell us he would ask if we wanted the test to see if the child would be Down syndrome, and he would always say, I'm not going to terminate the pregnancy if it is. And our answer always was, we won't either. So we never did the test, but that's where this can go if you decide that the child is not worth keeping. And what a thing to say. Like, how could it possibly be in our wisdom to say that a child with Down syndrome should not exist as opposed to existing? And so I don't think I'm talking to a group of people who, I don't think it even crosses our minds. I certainly hope not. But anyway, it's certainly, it's so terrible, it's just difficult to talk about. So I'd like to turn our minds to some other questions. The questions of why do we try so hard to control the conception and birth of children, both to not have children and to then try to have children? And I may say things that y'all will be very thankful that this is the last time you have to see me for a while, and that's okay. I accept that as a risk I'm willing to take. Let's look at some Bible verses to help us understand what God actually thinks about children and fertility. Genesis 1, keep going back to Genesis because, well, that's where we get some insight into the foundations of what God thinks. Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and said unto them, this is after he created male and female, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. And so, pretty clear that God intends for humans to reproduce. And you could maybe argue that that didn't work out so well for God, because a couple chapters later, he repents that he put man in the world at all, and he sends a flood. So it was a failed experiment, right? He should have just said, don't have children. But in Genesis chapter 9, after the flood, after that judgment, Genesis 9, verse 1, God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. So it's not over. The experiment's not done. And so we see that God intends for humans to be involved in the reproductive process, which is amazing, really. Why would God trust children to humans? Have you ever thought about that? Like that seems pretty risky. But he's decided that that's what he wants to do, and we would do well to enter into that with trust and also with a good deal of respect for both God and human life. Another thing that I think we need to recognize, and I don't have passages for each one of these, but God sometimes will close or open the womb, to use biblical terminology. We don't always know what all was going on in those scenarios. With our medical advances, we might be able to explain some of that away and have some other questions. However, we're just going to stick with what the Bible says. And so we have examples of Leah and Rachel, Hannah, and others who it specifically says God, like they were barren. And then through prayer or through some other divine intervention, they become, he says their womb is open and they bear children. And it's always viewed as a positive thing when that happened. It was never, oh, whoops, that shouldn't have happened. It's something that was sought for. These women cared a lot that they couldn't have children. And that should tell us something about, well, it's recorded in the Bible, and I think it tells us something about what God thinks about children. And if that's not enough, Psalm 127, the psalmist tells us in verse 3 that children are a blessing from the Lord. I think you might use the word heritage in the King James. Yes, Psalm 127:3, lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Now, if you're here this morning and you do have the pain of being barren, I don't want to add to that at all, but the fact that it's a pain speaks to something in your heart. But here, the psalmist believed that children were a blessing. He was not saying that this was a nuisance or a bother or something that should be avoided. The next passage that I am a little hesitant to mention because I know there's a lot going on. I'm not even going to read the passage, but you all, the Bible scholars, know the story of Onan and his actions. There's more going on there than simple contraception, but it is not a passage to ignore either. And so I will leave it at that. There's something going on there that's worth talking about when it comes to how does God view children. Just think about it. So let's talk a little bit about contraceptives. That's a big word that simply means that you are trying to evade the conception of children. Now, contraceptives and the use of contraceptive practices have been around since the Egyptians. It's a long history. But I'm going to blame feminism again for something here. And that is that when feminism was rising, that movement for equal treatment of women, the rights of their body and the reproductive rights and so on, and also the invention of contraceptive pills in the 1960s, I believe marks a dramatic shift away from the way childbearing and women's roles were understood. Now, I don't have the time or the knowledge at my fingertips to actually talk about that learnedly at this point, but I do believe that to be true. And I also believe that the development of contraceptive, easy contraceptive pills and so on, and other practices have led to the exponential rise in abortions, at least partly because the outcome of immoral sexual behavior was less likely to result in pregnancy. And if it did, then you would get a backup plan. If you think about it, it's really odd that if children are a result of sexual behavior that isn't right, according to the Bible, why would the backup plan not be repentance? No, the human solution is let's fix it our way, and we'll kill the baby now. That's what we're going to do instead of actually taking responsibility for our actions. That's usually the human response. So, a word to anyone who's newly married or thinking or in the childbearing stage of life, I would offer you a few thoughts for your consideration. I highly, highly recommend avoiding contraceptives that involve hormonal disruption for several reasons. And I would also recommend against other contraceptives, but the hormonal style, I believe, are especially dangerous, and I'll give you the reasons. Number one, I am convinced that there is a correlation between what seems to be the spike in barrenness and the use of contraceptive hormonal contraceptives. I'm convinced of that. I don't know that I'm qualified to make that statement, but observation is pretty powerful, and it's very difficult for me to shake that observation. So I'll leave that point at that. Second, I am not convinced that all pills do not have a Plan B effect to abort. I know what the labels say, but I guess living in Mississippi for 19 years makes you a little skeptical of professionals. I don't know. But it does seem to me that it's hard to trust people that set themselves up on a pedestal. Well, I'll just leave it at that. There's reasons that I'm skeptical that they don't all have a Plan B effect. And I would not ever want to be responsible for encouraging somebody in this particular path. So I'm taking the road of saying don't. Third, I believe that any contraceptive, hormonal or otherwise, can easily be based in selfishness to avoid the problems that children bring into our lives. I believe that. I'm not saying that that's always the motivation. I said it this way, that it can easily be based on that. And since it's so easy to do, well, then it's just one way to live in selfishness and not really think about what we're doing. The fourth reason that I recommend avoiding, especially hormonal contraceptives, is that it kills fish. Now, I did that on purpose. There has been a study, which is really interesting to me, but the wastewater that comes from processing, like water processing plants, they have discovered that it contains a higher level of contraceptive hormones, and studies have shown that this elevated hormone in the water is hard on male fish. And it can last for up to 3 generations of fish. Now, why do we care about fish? Well, because it might actually have some unwanted consequences for people. We don't know the answer to that yet. And so I'm bringing this up simply because, A, it's not a wacky conspiracy. There's actually proven science for this. I can give you the links if you want to read the articles. But it's also an example of men's selfishness having some bizarre unintended consequences. Whoever knew that taking a pill in the privacy of your house would someday kill fish? Well, why does it matter? We don't care about fish. Yes, we do care about fish. If you don't have any fish, you might be limited in your food. I mean, this is just the way nature works, and that's one of the reasons we try to live wisely as stewards, right? And finally, under the point of contraceptives and why I am, I don't know, but whenever I'm on these kind of subjects, I always struggle with knowing if you should try to balance everything, but it seems like if you balance it, then you undo everything you tried to say. So I'm just going to lean hard on the one side, and you're going to have to just bear with that. And if you want some more subtle nuances to it, talk to me later. But after sitting with couples who are wishing to get married, it's one of the things that I've made a practice in my bishop work. We just sit and talk about life, especially getting married and all the adjustments. And one of the things that we talk about is this thing of having children. And one of the things I've begun to understand and I share with these couples is that it's actually easier for people to have children than to avoid having them. The contraceptive methods seem easy, but they are just another thing that you have to think about. And if you are so concerned about it, it's going to interfere with your intimacy in many ways. And so I think it's just something to think about. It's a trade-off that I think young married couples really need to think about. It's a price that you may pay that you haven't thought through. All right, I'm going to keep being a little bit obnoxious for the next couple of minutes. That's all I'm going to say about contraceptives, but I'm not a fan, as you probably have picked up. And it's largely because, well, it just seems like a pre-runner to abortion to me. That's why I'm so adamant about that. Let's talk about conception, the flip side of contraception. While there are those who are desperately trying not to bear children, there are those who are desperately trying to bear children. That's an odd state of affairs. And as I said at the beginning, it seems to me that it's likely it could be the same couple. The advances in medical technology allow people to conceive and bear children in ways that are far from natural, and it allows infertile couples to bear children. And there's several ways that this could be done. I'll mention a few of them. One of them is in vitro fertilization. The slang term for it is test tube babies, in which the egg and the sperm are united in a lab, and then it's implanted into the womb to be carried to term. This process is highly invasive, and since it's so invasive, the typical practice is to harvest as many as 15 eggs at a time and fertilize them all, but only one is implanted. Well, then the big question is, what do you do with the rest? That is a big question. What about all of those eggs? If conception is the beginning of life, then what we've done is essentially put the pause button on those lives. Are you following that? And the question then is that okay? I read recently about the oldest baby. Did y'all read about that? It just comes to my mind. How old is it? 35? Yeah, something like that. So this baby was on pause for 35 years, and now it's just been born. Isn't that weird? How did we do that? Well, is that the best alternative? Is it better to kill them? Is it better to put them in the trash? Is it better to grow them into the stage where you can harvest stem cells, and then you can all of a sudden make all kinds of medical advances with fetal tissue because it's in that formation stage and you can solve cancer problems? These are huge questions, and they have some moral implications that I am not prepared. I don't know that I have an answer for them. All I'm saying is, if you're a couple here this morning desperate to have children, educate yourself about what you're about to do, and then think very carefully about what you're willing to, what are you willing to sacrifice in that process? Well, there's other ways that maybe people think about it. You can get sperm or egg donors. This is where you accept a cell from a third party. So then you would have huge questions like, whose child is this? Just because it was carried in a particular woman's womb doesn't necessarily mean that it's her child. So you have some genetic implications, legal implications, lots of questions, lots of questions. There's also surrogacy, where a woman carries an IVF to term for another couple. This would be done for homosexual couples. They do that some, where somebody will donate their body, or, well, they probably actually get paid pretty handsomely for it. But anyway, a woman will carry a child for a homosexual couple. Or if a woman has issues that prohibit the implanting of the IVF baby. And so I don't know what all the issues are here, but this is certainly a complex and questionable way of solving an infertility issue. And then we have snowflake babies, the slang term for embryo adoption. So what about all those eggs? Remember the lives that are on hold. Is it okay to adopt one of those and then let your wife carry it to term? Some Christians are seeing this as a good option rather than going through the IVF process themselves, because they're saving a life. I don't know why that feels like sand in my teeth, but I'm not a fan, and I'm not sure if I know why. I'll try to explain why, but I'm not sure if it's satisfactory. There are other ways. I mentioned the ones that seem to be the most likely temptations for us, but there are other ways that people try to correct the problem of a closed womb. Some may be fine. For instance, if there's a hormonal imbalance and that can be corrected maybe there's, you know, erratic cycles or inhospitable womb environment that can be corrected with simple adjustments of the woman's hormones or whatever. I don't know that I have huge issues with that. But all of this leads to a burning question for me. Do we or do we not accept God's will in our lives when it comes to the issue of childbearing? How far down the path of child sacrifice are we willing to travel with contraceptives? Or how determined are we to wrest control from God when we decide that we will have children? Period. Well, we need to wrap this up, don't we? How can we make decisions that are morally correct in an age where children are viewed as a nuisance or a necessity? How can we think through this? I would like to try to get some biblical grounding under us, because it seems like all we've done is throw a bunch of questions in the air. The Bible doesn't actually tell us what to do, or does it? Jesus is our Lord. He is our example. That's what we've been taught all of our lives. And one of the things that Jesus showed us in the Garden of Gethsemane is the amount of surrender that he was willing to go to as a man. After wrestling with God for quite a while about whether or not he was going to be killed by a bunch of evil men on a cross, even though I think he probably knew that he was going to be raised again, well, if you can avoid it, why not? But in the end, he came to a place of surrender when he said, "Thy will be done." And I believe this means in childbearing or in barrenness, we will never go wrong by cultivating the attitude of absolute surrender in our lives. I can't think of a single way that that would go wrong. And so that's a call to surrender, though, not just in fertility and childbearing. This is a call to surrender of everything in our lives. And this is what Christianity, I think the essence of Christianity is. It's a call to saying, "Not my will, thy will be done." And until we come to that place, I think we're going to be in the fog of whatever you want to call that, sin, distrust, and so on. Second principle, that's principle number one, we need to surrender. Second principle is that protecting our lives is a guaranteed failure. Jesus says, "Whosoever seeks to save his life will lose it." And I believe that this principle extrapolates to everything. And so whatever area of our life that we decide we're going to hang on to and we're going to protect and we are going to have it our way, we're going to surrender everything else to God, but this one thing we are not going to give up, I believe we will lose the very thing we're trying to hang on to. I've watched this happen. People, it seems to be anyway, it seems to be that people that will, you know, they will have all the time in the world with their families, and so they skip going to prayer meeting and all of this because they want time with their families. Their families grow up and leave home as fast as they can, and they're just out of there. They just go far away. They can't get away from home fast enough. And it makes me wonder, is there a correlation? It seems to me that there might be. I've seen people that are so bound and determined they're going to protect their emotional state and they're going to make sure they cut off all toxic relationships and they're going to do all of the things that psychologists tell you to do to make sure that you stay healthy and so on, only to struggle with depression and anxiety and panic. And you can keep taking that. Those are just two examples. Physical health might be another one. Just keep going down the list. But those of us who have decided that we're going to give our lives up and surrender, seems that Jesus is teaching us that whenever we try to save any aspect of our earthly life, we will end up losing the very thing that we think is going to give us security. And at the end of the day, that's idolatry, isn't it? James tells us, this is the third point of trying to get some biblical grounding under us, James tells us that taking care of the fatherless is part of true religion. So if for some reason barrenness is your calling in life, there are millions of not snowflake children that need homes. You don't have to experience pregnancy to have a fulfilling life. You say, how can a man say that? Well, I've never been pregnant. No, I shouldn't. That was bad. Forget I just did that. But my point is that you, as a woman, I would imagine that seems to be a step in a fulfilling life. But the truth is that many, many women have lived quite full lives without ever experiencing that, and they have found ways to do that. And many, many women have also pined away for years and years and years because they can't have children, and then they just are bound in the shallows of that misery. And so here's a few thoughts, though. Before adopting children, before taking foster children, or whatever else you're thinking of doing, I want to just offer four questions to ask yourself. Number one, am I doing this just because I believe I must be a parent to be a fulfilled person? And this question is getting at the root of my cautions about things like adopting snowflake babies and so on. I'm just going to leave that question the way I ask it. Second question, am I willing to accept counsel from my Christian community? What if they caution against adoption or fostering for me? Could I take no for an answer? Deciding to have children, for those of us who have had natural families, I know we don't take this question or this thought seriously enough, but having a family is not a personal decision when you're in a Christian community. It involves a lot of other people. And while I don't know that we should ask permission from our church to have children, that's not where I'm going with that. I think what we need to recognize is that if for some reason we have not been able to bear children, seeking to have a family through adoption or something like that, there's just another level of complexity to that. Having children is a complex thing. I'm not even trying to downplay that. And so when you add that level of complexity, maybe God has closed the womb for reasons that you don't see immediately in your own life. And when you seek that counsel, the kind wisdom of your brothers and sisters say, you know, I can't really give you a reference because of XYZ in your life. Could you accept that? If the answer to that is no, I'm submitting to you that the motivations for having a family are probably not right. Third thing, am I ready to shoulder the responsibility of children that are not my own? The most abusive people in the world are step-parents. Did you know that? There's a reason for that. There's something about your own DNA looking back at you through the eyes of your children that makes you a different person. Now, yes, people abuse their biological children, but the rates, the percentages of abuse by step-parents is off the charts compared to biological. That's something that must be considered. You are taking responsibility of children that are not yours. Are you ready to accept that responsibility? And I'm not saying you shouldn't be. I'm just saying these are questions that I think need to be answered. The fourth question when considering the solving of infertility, am I taking responsibility where I should be offered on the altar of sacrifice time and energy to the biological parents to raise their child? In other words, a friend of mine has a story of a missionary that he knows personally, and I don't know the man, so this is somebody I don't know. But they were in another country, and this woman brought her child to him. And she said, I want you to take my child and raise it. I can't do it. And the man refused to take the child. He said, for me to do that would take the responsibility off of you. And what you need to do is take the responsibility for your actions and raise the child. We'll support you. We'll help you in any way we can. But we're not going to take your child from you. I don't know that I have anything more to say about that. It's worth thinking about. Is it possible that what God is calling me to do is actually give time and energy to someone to support them to raise their child, and I don't get to take that child from them? All right, that's taking care of orphans. Another Bible principle, or I don't know if it's a Bible principle, but it's certainly, it's an observation It's a principle. I don't know if I can find a Bible verse, but there probably should be a Bible verse for it. Child sacrifice doesn't just happen in clinics tucked away out of the public eye. I submit to you that every day children are sacrificed on the altars of divorce, single moms, deadbeat dads. Now, I understand if you're a single parent here because you lost your husband or your wife to disease or illness. That is a totally different story. That does not fit what I'm talking about here. This is people who have made the choice to walk away from responsibilities that should be theirs. And children are being sacrificed on that altar today. We may be guilty of versions of this when we have dads who work long hours and never see the family awake except for Sundays and Saturdays, perhaps. I'm suggesting, more than suggesting, I'm submitting to you that we could be guilty of child sacrifice if we have arranged our lives in that manner. Second, I think we could be guilty of versions of child sacrifice when a mother feels that she absolutely must engage in her hobbies and interests at the expense of time with her children. Or we may be guilty of child sacrifice when we have marriages that are so broken that divorce has already happened, but because of our beliefs and our culture, we can't separate. Now, arguably, I'm going to stand on this. I would argue that that's still better than complete separation. Having two miserable parents in the house is better than separation. But fix your marriage, folks, because that's where you're going to find the most stability for your children. And you won't be sacrificing them on the altar of your bitterness and resentment toward your spouse. Child sacrifice still happens when we abuse our children with words of blame, anger, harsh punishments for simply failing to meet our expectations. This is not a child training message, but correction for our children, punishment for our children, is not when they fail to meet our expectations. That is not what correction is for. And of course, we will sacrifice our children if, God forbid, we are sexually molesting or assaulting them. I believe that child sacrifice still happens when we do not lovingly and firmly correct their wrongdoing, or when we behave as if we believe that they were special beyond anyone else and never could be corrected or involved in any wrongdoing. I believe those are areas that we today could be guilty of sacrificing our children. As I was pondering this, it occurred to me to ask the question that didn't occur to me in the other messages, but it came to me as I was studying this particular message. Usually in the lie, there's some truth. And so the question came to me, what is the truth behind this lie? Because there are examples of child sacrifice that are not condemned in the Bible. And that was weird for me to process. So hear me out if you've never thought of it that way. And I may be totally off, but think about it with me. I think we could argue that Moses was sacrificed in a way. He was certainly given up. He was given away. And so in a way, you could say that he was sacrificed. Isaac was as good as sacrificed. Hebrews makes that clear, that Abraham's last hope was for some sort of resurrection. And so there's that story. Jesus is the Son of God, and he was given as a sacrifice. So what's the truth behind the falsehood? What am I trying to even get at here? It seems to me that when we go back to the original idea of replenishing and of multiplying and replenishing the earth, we are stewards of our children. We are given these children for a time to take care of them, but then we are called to release them back to their Creator to do whatever it is that He wants to do with them. And we don't get to always say what that is. In fact, I would say maybe we never get to say what that is. And so when a parent watches their child leave home to a far country, do they feel that they've sacrificed their child? I would submit to you, yes, they are. And sometimes children are called into situations where they're killed on those fields. Well, that's the ultimate sacrifice. Should they have never let that child exist? Should they have aborted that pregnancy? Should they have... How could we ever answer that question? We can't answer that question. And so, as we trust God with our children, The truth behind the lie is that God will ask us to release our children to him, but we don't do this by killing them. We give him our children as living sacrifices, and then we let him do with them what he wants to do. In conclusion, we reject the idea that human life is a scourge on the earth. We reject the idea that children are a nuisance. We wholeheartedly surrender God's plan to God's plan for fertility and conception. We wholeheartedly surrender to God's plan for marriage as a safe and stable environment for children. And we wholeheartedly partner with God and sincerely pray, "Thy will, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven." God bless you.